Sharon Pasricha knows every detail counts in the world of hospitality. And it's why the founder and CEO of Ennismore pushes his team to constantly think outside the box in designing and improving the offerings of the hotels and restaurants in the firm's portfolio. You'll likely know of the Hoxton. The hotel brand has properties in London's Shoreditch and Holborn, along with Amsterdam, Paris, Williamsburg, and Portland, with new locations set to open in Chicago's West Loop, downtown Los Angeles, and Southwark in London. The company has also created a host of restaurant brands and has breathed new life into historic Glen Eagles in Scotland. All of Ennismore's properties are unique, inspired by the neighborhoods where they exist. It's part of Sharon's mission to build lasting and engaging social hubs while also creating great places to work. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. For today's program, I sat down with Sharon at Midori House to hear about his journey, how to build a great team, and the future of hospitality.
So I was born in Bombay in India. I guess if you were born there, you can still call it Bombay. Otherwise, you've got to call it Mumbai. And I spent the first 10 years of my life in Bombay and then left when I was 10 to go up to boarding school up in northern part of India called the Doon School. So I spent the first 15 years of my life in India, traveling around India. I come from a very entrepreneurial family. My dad's been an entrepreneur his entire life, as I've been an entrepreneur my entire life. So I guess fairly unemployable at this stage. But it was great traveling around India, getting to learn about the culture as I grew up. And that was a really special part of my upbringing.
So after boarding school, you get into the world of finance and sort of go down that path, ended up in the UK. But were you running any businesses? Do you do anything on the side that sort of allowed you to follow that passion in doing your own thing?
Yeah, I've always had a bit of hustle. I think my first business was, funny enough, selling cheese sandwiches in school. In my early years, I would go home and tell my mom I absolutely loved her cheese sandwiches, and she would kind of whip up even more for me, take them to school, and I'd sell them for 1 rupee. And I used to love comic books at that point in time. So I would take the 1 and 2 rupees I'd make selling these sandwiches and go buy comic books. Until one day at a parent-teacher association, one of my friends came up to my mom and said, "Mrs. Pasricha, do you think it's fair that the sandwiches are now 5 rupees? And that's when the penny dropped. Well, my mom, here she thought I loved her sandwiches. And there was me charging exorbitantly for these sandwiches. So I think therein lies my first lesson in business is don't get greedy. Keep those margins consistent as long as people are buying things. But, you know, I always had an entrepreneurial hustle. I've done so many varied jobs over the years, from retail to restaurants to just such a wide range. I think it's doing a lot of things that allow you to pinpoint what you really love eventually doing. So I threw myself in lots of different situations.
You were working with some VCs, a number of other places, doing different things before hospitality came around. But where did that start? Where did your interest in restaurants and hotels, where did that really start up?
So my first business straight out of college in London was a media startup where, funny enough, we had a business plan to get into the publishing business.
So what year are we talking here?
It was 1998. And we wrote a business plan. We were funded by the Prince's Trust to develop a student publication, which ran for 2 publications. It was called Rush. And it was actually, at the time, the largest freely circulated student magazine in the country. So we would go and buy media space across, you know, a lot of the universities and campuses in the UK and distribute this student publication. And it was an amazing entrepreneurial venture, you know, learning about ad sales, learning about finance, learning about cash flows, learning about marketing. I think one of the things we realized early on is actually advertisers were more interested in our distribution network than they were in the actual ad sales itself. So very quickly, our company morphed into a student marketing business, which we ran for 3 years. So I kind of caught the entrepreneurial bug very early on, much against my parents' wishes, who, like most Indian kids, wanted a very stable education and a stable job for their kids. But I think they realized that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So I was, they were very supportive by the end of it. I then ran that business for 3 years and had the opportunity to run a manufacturing business, which was set up by my uncle's father. This has took me back to India. So having lived in India for the first 15 years and then come to London for education and college, I'd moved back for 3 years to run his factory in Delhi. Now, this is a factory that he had run, his father had set up, and he had run for several years, but was loss-making, and had a number of CEOs over the last couple of years. And he basically said to me, he goes, "Look, you've run the student marketing business fairly successfully in the UK. This is a manufacturing business that exports leather jackets and leather garments. Can you help us find new buyers?" So there I was reminding him that I've never actually been to a factory before, let alone run one. And he said, hey, if I can find somebody who's a family member that I can trust to at least steady the ship, I'd be incredibly happy. So off I went to Delhi for a weekend, really to suss this factory out. And, you know, here was a 60,000 square foot factory with 300 employees that really blew my mind. I'd never seen a factory of this scale before. And then to be given the opportunity to run it was just absolutely amazing. Now, what I didn't know at the time was how much work it would entail. So when I thought I'd spend half my time in the UK trying to find new buyers, you know, the penny dropped very early on. Here was a loss-making factory that needed some invasive work before you could even sell one more jacket. So long story short, I spent 3 years running a manufacturing business in Delhi, which is really where I cut my teeth. And that's where I learned the hard, brutal world of business on the shop floor. It was a fascinating time in my life, and I made some horrendous decisions, made a few good ones. But really, kind of self-reflecting, it was probably the time where I kind of honed in a lot of my business acumen. Anyway, I spent 3 years, 2 years of which was sort of turning around this factory, making some very difficult decisions, and then spent the final year and a half kind of growing the business and driving more sales. And I was at a fork in the road at that point where I decided one option is, do I become the Leather King of India and become the biggest, baddest factory that exists, or do I go and find my next fix as an entrepreneur? And I think the truth of the matter is I really struggled with the industry I was in. I was in manufacturing. I had pretty much no barriers to entry. My competitors would use, you know, the same supply chain I had. We use the same workers I had. My buyers would drop me for a dollar, you know, go to China and go to Turkey. So I didn't really have a competitive edge. So coming to work every single day without knowing that I've got a unique proposition or a competitive edge, I really struggled with that notion. So it was a fairly easy decision for me to kind of transition out of that business. We hired a CEO who kind of took over the day-to-day, and I kind of then needed to find my next fix. Business school seemed like a good 2 year, let's go and figure it out, which is kind of what brought me back to London. Around the same time, I met my current wife, and we both missed London. Having spent so many years in London, I really wanted to come back. 2 years of business school was great. As an entrepreneur, I was the guy that sat in the back row looking up the ceiling, really thinking of, you know, what I wanted to do, and I knew I had 2 years to go and figure it out. During my second year, I spent the summer working, which is really my only real job I've ever had, working for a private equity fund. And while I was working there is when they started looking at hotels and student accommodation. And for me, that's really when the penny dropped. I was sent into a hotel and I absolutely was fascinated by the workings of a hotel. Not just the real estate, but the operations, the systems, the process, the marketing, the brand. It spoke to me in so many different ways where, you know, I love architecture. I love understanding what makes brands relevant. It also helps that I love eating, drinking, and sleeping, which kind of ticks all three boxes for the world of hotels.
So you become enamored with the idea of the hotel world. But what state was the hotel industry in at that time? I mean, this is early 2000s.
You know, I've always been fascinated with hotels, generally as a traveler, as a kind of curious traveler. I've been that person that looks under the bed, that person that opens the windows and opens the drawers and tries to work out and understand how things really work. Equally, I was always perplexed as to how hotels were so utilitarian, why hotels were all about just simply offering a very functional product. My view is as society changed, as the social age began, where you stay today says so much more about who you are than it did 10 years ago, even 20 years ago. But yet hotels weren't transforming in the same light. People wanted hotels to be an extension of who they are and wanted to reflect who they are, their preferences, their likes. And no longer were hotels simply about offering a bedroom for a night. So I was kind of fixated with trying to understand why so many hotels were so formulaic in their delivery. The second thing that I often struggled with the world of hotels is why hotels would charge for things that they really shouldn't, like that £5 bottle of water by your bedside or that $4 Kit Kat bar that's in the minibar, all those sorts of things, or Wi-Fi. I always struggled with trying to understand why weren't hotel restaurants good? Why weren't hotels interesting meeting spaces or places to meet? And why did they charge for things? Perhaps they didn't. So I sort of had this subconsciously at the back of my mind for a very long time. And I think today at the Hoxton and it's more generally, it's a reflection of a lot of my pet hates that I disliked about hotels. And in Hoxton is a, you know, I think it's an amazing product, which is almost a town hall. It's about bringing the outside in and really inspiring cultural discovery. but yet we don't charge for things we shouldn't. I don't believe hotels should be making money on expensive Kit Kat bars and Wi-Fi and bottles of water. Mm. And that's been a really interesting kind of journey for me.
So tell me about the purchase of the Hockton, where you came to take over that brand. And does the creation of Ennismore come first, the parent company, or is it taking on the Hockton first?
Ennismore was where I lived, right? So I lived in Ennismore Gardens and I looked out the window one day and thought, God, I need a name for my company. So with complete creative block, I looked at Ennismore Gardens and I figured, let's just call it Ennismore because it's easiest. So I needed a company to ultimately make the acquisition for the Hockton. The Hockton was founded in 2006. It was founded in East London in Shoreditch by a group of entrepreneurs that wanted to do things differently. And Shoreditch certainly wasn't the Shoreditch it is today. It had a very industrial past, but over the years, there's been an amazing creative present. I got involved in early 2000s. 2011, actually, is when we ultimately bought and took over the original Hockton. It was an amazing product, but it was a single hotel. It was in an area that was changing rapidly, and while the area was changing rapidly, so were its public spaces and the demands on its restaurant and its bedrooms. So I went in and basically spent the first year after we acquired the single hotel and learned everything about the business. And I believe as an entrepreneur, the best way to learn is by doing. Everything from the back of house to the housekeeping to the reservations, revenue management, front of house. And I don't think we did anything particularly clever, but we just kind of slowly but surely made a few changes and a few tweaks, whether it's bringing on new partners, bringing on new teams, spending money in areas where we thought were greatest impact. And over the course of a year, we saw the ship changing. We saw some of the changes we were making and the value add in the business. And very quickly, I realized, actually, here's something that I think is something that could be scaled and could be replicated, not just in Shoreditch, but other exciting neighborhoods around the world. Mm. The challenge was, of course, where do you find the next Shoreditch, right? Shoreditch is one of those once-in-a-generation neighborhoods, which, you know, says so much about who we are as a brand. I stumbled across a building in Holborn, which is kind of this weird part of town in London, which is, you know, they call it Midtown.
You're kind of caught between two worlds,
exactly.
Aren't
you? You're either in the West End or you're in the city, and Holborn kind of got left behind. Like, why was anyone ever going to be in Holborn? But actually, part of the positioning of the neighborhood meant that the value of the real estate at the time was affordable and accessible, which allowed us to purchase this building, you know, sensibly. And, you know, for us at the Hockton, it's always about offering good value. We're never going to be budget, but it's a value-based price based on some of the competitors and what you ultimately get. We ended up buying this building in what I think was a difficult building in a very sleepy neighborhood.
Around 2010, you say?
It was 2012 that we bought this building. It's about a year and a half after we bought the original Hockton. And I guess at that point, I had to learn how to be a developer, right? I've cut my teeth running a hotel, virtually living in this hotel. I've redone my house, but it's a whole different thing taking an office building and converting it into a hotel. But you know what? Much like the leather factory, I learned some hard mistakes by doing. My mantra has always been to surround yourself with people that are way smarter than you, that can kind of add value to your business in perhaps ways that you can't. So I've surrounded myself with people who've done it before. A lot of decisions were kind of gut intuition based. A lot of them were based on best practice from the skill set that I'd surrounded myself with. But you know, the 2 years that we spent redeveloping this office building into a hotel, I learned a ton. Mm. And from the day we opened, which is 2014, that hotel's never dropped below 90% occupancy. Wow. So it gave us a lot of confidence to say, do you know, all the moves that we're making here, the thinking about how the ground floor works, making sure we're not positioning the public spaces as a hotel destination, but a destination for the neighborhood, making sure it's accessible, it's affordable, providing people with comfortable spaces to meet, to greet, you know, and whether it's people from the neighborhood, whether it's people who live and work in the area or people coming from out of town.
I wonder if we could just look at the industry at the time. I wonder if how conscious you were of what was going on in the wider hospitality and hotel industry, because this is at a time after the financial crash and things are coming up like Airbnb and people are traveling a little bit differently. But what was it like and did you care at all? Did you see a new model that you thought was going to work no matter what?
Oh, I totally did. I was very inspired by Airbnb. And actually, people often ask me whether Airbnb is a competitor to us. And actually, the truth is, they're so not. I think what they've done is paved the way for a new type of traveler that wants to see a city and a neighborhood through the lens of somebody that lives there. And really, that's what the ethos of the Hockton is. Mm. Our ethos is we are not a big box hotel. If you want to go and visit Amsterdam and get a feel for the city as a local would, we'll go and stay at the Hockton. Very similar to somebody who wants to stay at Airbnb that's in somebody's house. The average length of stay for us is a lot shorter than perhaps an Airbnb. And there's a lot more surety of what you're getting, comforts that you're getting, whether you're staying in hotels. So, you know, it's a different type of product for different type of travelers. But what was most interesting for me was this shift where people wanted a product that was reflective of them, but also reflective of the neighborhood that they were visiting. And I think we really, really kind of honed that in. So while you look at our collection of hotels, whether it's in Paris or Amsterdam or Brooklyn or Portland, each and every one of them is reflective of that neighborhood. You know, whether it's finding designers to design the uniforms, to finding amazing local restaurateurs to kind of help us with the food and beverage, to the curation of events that we put on, to the furniture design and the lighting design that goes into it. And I think that that's painstakingly hard to do every single time in every different neighborhood you do. It's almost like starting a whole new hotel brand every single time. But I think in that creative madness lies some of the secret sauce that we've managed to create as a hotel group. You know, all of our hotels run year-round at 90% occupancy. We've got a high repeat guest business. It's evenly keeled between kind of corporates, so people that are coming there from local businesses that are staying, and people that are coming for travel, which is a lovely mix that we like between the two. And our public spaces are a destination not for people necessarily just living in the hotel, but for locals, which is always a bit of an acid test for us. Success for us is not always defined by, are we running at 90% occupancy and high ADRs and what have you. It's really how well each of our hotels engage with the neighborhood that we're in and how we connect with the locals that live there. And, you know, keep in mind when you were, we were opening Amsterdam and Paris, I mean, the French don't go and hang out in hotels. The Dutch don't go to hotels to go and hang out. They don't go there for a coffee. They don't go there for a meal. And that was an interesting cultural shift where, you know, we were bracing ourselves and keeping our fingers crossed thinking, shit, what if they don't actually turn up? And I think, you know, there you've got to really run by your own conviction because you're designing spaces that are all about making people feel comfortable. They're never over-designed, never trying to be on trend. None of our, you know, we don't talk about being cool at the office ever. That word is absolutely banned. We don't talk about being trendy, that word is banned as well. It's about being timeless. It's about creating spaces that are comfortable, that allow people and individuals to interact in a social environment that make them feel comfortable.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that curation. I mean, you've mentioned the occupancy rates a couple of times. So when you're looking at neighborhoods where you think this is going to work, I mean, you mentioned that cool is banned, but these are places that have a little bit of buzz around them, where people are used to co-working spaces and great coffee and, you know, great offerings like that. So how conscious are you when you're going into these places about it will work because it's just going to fit in the neighborhood?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, look, if I take a step back and look at our business, we're a fully integrated, I hate that word, but we're fully vertically integrated hospitality company. Everything from the real estate, you know, we own all our own real estate. So there's a huge skill set within the business about traveling to these interesting cities and neighbors and then identifying these buildings, eventually financing them, buying them and building them to in-house creative. We've got about 80 designers within our business that do everything from furniture design, lighting design, interiors, web, graphics, digital, everything the guest touches and sees and feels, our team have had a hand in. Then, of course, finally operating these establishments from restaurants and bars. So much of our value proposition is identifying these neighborhoods early on. So there's a huge amount of time that goes into finding these neighborhoods and finding these buildings. Of course, in this business, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs, right? You've got to literally go and look at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of buildings before identifying the right one. For me, it hasn't been a straightforward exercise, but you can, a lot of these decisions are made by your gut, right? I mean, no spreadsheet's ever going to be able to tell you necessarily whether something's going to work, because invariably you have that first mover advantage. We were one of the first hotels in Shoreditch. We were one of the first hotels in Fulton Market in Chicago, one of the first hotels coming early on into downtown LA. So I think when you're trying to underwrite these things, you're trying to really understand, is it going to work? You've got to kind of bite the bullet a little bit and kind of really run with some of your conviction. For me, the mantra has always been to follow the independents. We tend to follow, where's a sous chef from Manhattan going that now wants its big break, his or her big break, and you've got to find the areas of low rent. So they all went over to Brooklyn and started doing pop-ups to start off with, and then started emerging with their own restaurants. Where do the independent artists go? Where do the independent restaurant groups go? Where are the art galleries? Where is the independent theater? And I think if you kind of follow in the independents, you've got a good starting point for what's happening. And of course, a lot of these old industrial areas with beautiful architecture and lovely loft buildings became a hub for a lot of creatives to kind of showcase their craft. Whether it's Brooklyn or Williamsburg, for that matter, which had this kind of industrial past, much like Shoreditch did, now a very creative present. Downtown LA, that's had this amazing resurgence over the last, you know, couple of years and no doubt into the next decade. So I think so much is kind of gut and intuition based, but we tend to kind of spend a lot of time thinking about where are the fiercely independent retailers and coffee shops and artists and artisans, where are they going and why are they going there? And then, of course, for a hotel to finally find a home in one of these neighborhoods, you do need a critical mass. So there's no secret, you know, people from Williamsburg are moving to other parts of Brooklyn that first moved into Williamsburg. Similarly, people in Shoreditch have been priced out. They lived there 10 years ago because now the office rents are a lot higher. So they're going further east into kind of Dalston and even further east than that. So I think you need an element of critical mass to create a hotel because fundamentally our business model works when there's enough density of residents, enough density of offices and kind of commercial space. So it's difficult. If you're in too early, how are you going to get people to come and stay with you? So you've got to find that right balance. You know, we're spending time in cities like Austin and cities like Detroit, interesting parts of Miami, which are kind of changing. And I hate the word gentrifying, but really, you know, moving on and kind of changing.
You have really nailed this brand, and the growth seems very considered. But where does Glen Eagles come into the conversation? That's a different one. This is a heritage hotel, a totally different brand. Where does that come into your portfolio?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I've stayed at Glen Eagles over the years, over the last probably 10 years, maybe a dozen times. My wife's actually born in Scotland, so I'd be dragged up to Scotland a few times a year to see her family, and we'd stayed in Glen Eagles. And actually, I've sort of done the routine probably around 8 years ago where I sat at the bar in Glen Eagles having a drink, wondering, God, if I ever got the keys to this place, I wonder what I'd do. So I sort of played it out in my head in my wildest dreams. I never thought we'd have the opportunity to actually take the hotel over. I think we were in the right place at the right time. I've always romanticized to think through, well, you know, we've done a great job with the World of the Hoxton using an amazing multidisciplinary team from technology to fashion to PR to FMCG. Most of the people that we employ in our business are outside of the world of hospitality to really kind of question and ask why. With that same team, what else could we do for the world of hospitality? And on that journey, we'd stumbled on Glen Eagles. It was owned by Diageo for 30 years. It was a 1,000-acre estate that was effectively a cross between a conference venue and a golfing destination. It had amazing bones, but lost a bit of soul and didn't have any vision or kind of strategy. We were at the right place at the right time. And really, our thesis at the time was it was never going to be Hoxton. It's never going to be an urban, relevant, culturally inspired neighborhood hotel. Here was a 1,000-acre village with the most amazing pursuits that existed, yet people only knew about it because of its golf and because it hosted the G8 Summit and the Ryder Cup. So we spent the last 3 years really, unlike the Hoxton, where all we're doing is looking out to bring the outside in, for Glen Eagles, we just lifted the lid on this 100 years of history that we had and just went back into the archives to think through, well, why was this hotel started in the first place? Here was this amazing hotel that was founded at the end of a railway line in the 1920s. And in the 20s and 30s, this hotel was on the social calendar. People would race the train up in their cars from London right up to Glen Eagles. There was cocktails on tap. There was live jazz being streamed from our ballroom on BBC Radio. It was a romantic, amazing, glamorous destination where actually people were allowed to be naughty. And over the years, Glen Eagles took itself too seriously because it started hosting these very serious events. So our entire thesis was actually, let's go bring this hotel back to the 1920s and 30s that it once was, this glorious playground where actually you can go and do stuff. And guess what? You can be naughty while you're doing it as well. So shooting, fishing, archery, off-roading, gun dogs, all these amazing pursuits, we didn't create them. They always existed. We just shone a light on them. And we allowed our beautiful, amazing people that work for us and the creative teams that work for us to just dial up the storytelling. So, I don't know, 10 years ago when you went shooting, you'd probably go shooting in a battered old Viano with somebody wearing a purple tie. I don't know if anyone wants to go shooting wearing in a Viano with somebody wearing a purple tie. Today you go shooting with Ian dressed in his amazing Purdy attire with a Land Rover Discovery. And he'll tell you stories about when he went and shot 50 pheasants or when the clays were absolutely amazing one day. And just that element of storytelling is completely dialed up. We've got the most amazing and knowledgeable people that work for us that are champions in their field of falconry and archery and shooting and fishing, off-roading, and, you know, world-class and world champions, allowing them to dial up that storytelling that in beautifully curated spaces was really what we did. And you know what? 3 years in, it's a great sense of pride for me because we've got people now coming from further away, staying with us, doing a lot more. We won Best UK Hotel this year, Condé Nast, number one. Last year, we won top 20 hotels in the world. So it's amazing for me to see the kind of recognition we're getting, given everything we've done with Gleneagles.
I want to hear a little bit about the team at Ennismore. But first, I understand that you're still very heavily involved in the concept of your new brands and your new hotels, all the details that go into it. What's that like for you? And how important is that as a leader to still be involved in the details of the new properties?
Well, hang on. Who have you been speaking to, my team? Do you know, it's interesting as an entrepreneur. I'm a very atypical entrepreneur where I'm a control freak, micromanaging, I want to know everything kind of guy. And that doesn't work in an organization that's scaling fast, that's growing incredibly quickly, that's attracting amazingly smart people in the organization, right? So I've had to learn how to adjust my management style and, frankly, learn to be a CEO. So the founder entrepreneur bit actually comes to me quite naturally. The CEO bit I'm learning, and I'm learning every single day. And part of that learning is the ability to stand back and the ability to let people in front of you drive and make mistakes and encourage them to make those mistakes, but fail fast. You know, my mantra, as I said to you earlier, has always been to kind of hire people that are way smarter than I am. And of course, when I do that, you know, the bandwidth starts maybe fairly small, but very, very quickly kind of opens up. And we now have a group of intrapreneurs within the organization that have to make decisions real time and fast. There are elements in the business that I absolutely do not need to get involved in, that I absolutely do get involved in, primarily because I love them and I enjoy it. Involved in all the new brands, 100%. I tend to spend a lot of my time. We've set up in a small innovation lab last year that is very involved in kind of stargazing. I was very inspired by an interview Jeff Bezos made last year where he talked about people come up to him and say, Jeff, you've had an amazing quarter. Well done. Your stock market's at an all-time high. And what he said was, well, actually, what you're really saying is we had an amazing quarter 3 years ago because nothing I do is this quarter or this year. It's all 2-3 years. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, we're building spaces that are going to open in 2-4 years, yet I don't have anyone in the organization stargazing. Like, what is the future of work? What is the future of hotels? Will you have a reception desk going forward? Will you even have servers coming to serve you? And for an organization like ours, it's kind of building spaces of the future. We didn't have a dedicated team to think about it. I spent a bit of time, pulled together a small team of futurists, creative directors, insight directors. So it's a very small team, but they are not allowed to work on any projects within the business that are this month, this quarter, even frankly this year. All they're doing is looking into the future. And some of my best moments are with this team as we stargaze, what is the future of work and what are we doing about designing certain spaces for the future traveler.
That's all the time we have on today's show. Thank you very much to Sharon Pasricha for sharing the story of Ennismore. This show was mixed and edited by Alex Port-Felix and researched by Mariana LaGrasta. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening and goodbye.